This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today we are hitting the open ocean, learning about some of its myths and meanings and challenges. Now to its shrinking bounty. With the world's population at 7 billion and rising, the demand for high-protein foods is also on the rise. According to a study released yesterday from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, fish consumption has risen from an annual average of 22 pounds per person in the 1960s to nearly double that in 2012. And that number is expected to rise another 35% in the next 20 years. Here's the problem. Where will all that fish come from? And can those demands be met sustainably? Joel Bourne wrote about farming fish for the June issue of National Geographic. Among other things, his article revealed the surprising statistic that in 2012, aquaculture exceeded beef production. I asked him what is pushing that demand upward.
We've got seafood's reputation as a much healthier type of food than, say, beef or pork or even chicken. You've also got growing economies in Asia, India and China in particular, who like seafood, eat a lot of it, and they're driving those numbers up. So seafood has always been typically more expensive than some of these other meats. So the incredible demand is just pushing those production numbers up.
But at the same time, the catch of wild fish has stagnated. Why? Is that just overfishing?
Absolutely. We've been pounding wild fish since the end of, World War II, when we really started to get small vessels with diesel engines, and then when all the great electronics came on board that even recreational fishers like myself use now, it makes it a lot easier to catch a lot more fish a lot more quickly. So the wild stocks of fish have pretty much plateaued. We've had the same amount since about the mid-1990s, and with the demand expected to increase more than 35% over the next couple of decades, all that new fish supplies are going to have to come from aquaculture.
Well, and as it is now, it looks like the U.S. is importing 90% of its seafood, around 2% of which is inspected by the FDA. The other completely unregulated?
Regulated but not inspected very closely. There's this old adage that you go to the seafood market and you could smell it if the fish was bad, mm-hmm. So you didn't need to worry about inspections. Unfortunately, with aquaculture and in some cases wild caught fish, that's not the case anymore. These contaminants that they're finding in there, are concerning.
Well, Joel, even when we hear the words farmed fish, many people do think of the overcrowded industrial farms here on land, not to mention, the salmon pens that we've been hearing about for years. You found a number of people in aquaculture today trying to avoid the mistakes of factory farming of, pigs, pork and poultry and beef, for example. How so? What are they doing?
Well, we tried to look at a couple of different industries that seem to show the best way for us to move forward. One of them, is moving all these fisheries on land.
Mm-hmm.
These look almost very similar to the CAFOs that you see with pigs, where you've got, everything crowded into a warehouse with a lot of fish in a very small space. However, fish, especially fish like tilapia, actually like to be fairly close together. They're schooling fish. They don't seem to mind the density quite so much. And because of their feed conversion ratios, they're very efficient. And you can reduce the impacts. You can treat the sewage that comes out of them. So that was one particular method. The other we looked was going way offshore, off into the offshore waters off the coast of Panama, where one particular company is trying to basically do what Jacques Cousteau said we had to do back in the 60s and 70s, really farm the oceans.
Let's dig into those a little bit. You mentioned CAFOs. I just want to clarify, concentrated animal feeding operations. These are these big, huge industrial farms that spew out a lot of waste. First, to the land fishing, the land aquaculture example, off the Blue Ridge Mountains in Martindale, Virginia, of all places. Now, what are they farming there?
Well, they've got one of the largest indoor fish farms in the world, and they're growing tilapia right next to a NASCAR speedway. it's hysterical. So they've got this native of the Nile, this fast-growing fish it's an omnivore. So they feed it mostly grain, and it's an incredibly intensive process. but it's tightly controlled to keep diseases out, and they've been very successful with it. They've been doing it for about 20 years now, it's been so successful, the owner has been asked to build these things in places like Egypt and Africa, where they really have a serious need for more fish protein.
How do they keep them disease-free? I mean, the photograph from your article show them overflowing with tilapia.
You know, it's amazing. There, he's got a water treatment system and an oxygenation system that's sort of like a water treatment system for a small town. So the fish are constantly bathed in ozonated water that keep them alive. And they live to eat, and that's what they do.
Mm. Joel Bourne is with us. He's a contributing writer for National Geographic. He's written an article called How to Farm Better Fish. It's in the June issue of National Geographic. Well, let's go to the other end of things, off land. Open Blue, this is in Panama. Biggest operation, I believe, open ocean fish farm in the world. And it's owned by an American, Brian O'Hanlon, third generation fishmonger from Long Island. Why isn't it in the U.S.?
Well, you know, Brian's got an interesting story. He tried to do a fish farm in Puerto Rico and had a small experimental farm there for many years. He could not get a commercial license from the Puerto Rican authorities, which, of course, use the same regulations as they do in the United States. And because of the competition for our coastal zone, as well as sort of hardcore opposition from commercial fishing guys, the wild fish fishermen, we have not been, regulatorily at least, very friendly toward aquaculture in the United States.
Hmm.
He was unable to get permits to expand his operation, and finally, after 5 years of trying, just gave up. He found a place in Panama. They said, come on down. The government was very open and friendly to him as long as he employed Panamanians, which he does. And so he moved there, I think, in the late 2000, before 2010, 2007, something like that, and has been expanding ever since.
Now, what are they farming there?
These are cobia. These are saltwater species that are very common amongst recreational fishermen in the South, but they've never been caught commercially because they don't school like other fish. But they're delicious. My friends and I catch them down here in North Carolina, and they're apparently very good to farm.
But still, he's yet to turn a profit, despite demand for a high-end fish. Why not?
Well, the costs of going offshore are phenomenal. I mean, you've got 200 guys. They go out to these farms. They're 8 miles offshore, and they have to go service them every day. So he's got a fleet of boats. He's got divers with hard hats. He's got an ocean-going tug that he has to use to move these big things around. I mean, this is a major operation. And so he's hoping to break even next year. And the thing about O'Hanlon, he's one of these guys who's on the frontier. He's got a lot of investors that are banking on him turning a profit and doing well. And if he succeeds, I think you're going to see a lot more of this type of investment around the world.
Okay, so we've looked at examples of aquaculture on land, in the ocean. Polyculture, this is something on Vancouver Island. This polyculture apparently has its roots in ancient China. What is it exactly?
Well, it's really cool. It's basically where you grow several species in one particular area. You feed one. In this case, it's a sablefish,
mm-hmm.
but it's also marketed as black cod.
Okay.
So this particular researcher up at University of Vancouver has taken a small experimental salmon farm, and he's feeding these one species, these black cod, but all around the farm he's put these Chinese lantern baskets of Japanese scallops, and then he's got seaweed sort of wrapped around those to collect a lot of the nutrients that are coming out of the fish waste. And underneath it, he has sea cucumbers, these echinoderms that are just ugly as can be, but the Chinese love them, and they sell them for about $1 a piece. And they're down at the very bottom of the beneath the cages, eating up any of the solids that the fish tend to leave. So essentially, he's feeding one species and growing seven others all around it.
Huh.
And it's just an extremely interesting system. And the ancient Chinese, of course, did this with carp and rice polyculture for thousands upon thousands of years. They were among the first fish farmers in the world. And this sort of rice fish type of polyculture is one of the things that sort of has sustained their diet for generations and generations. And it's coming back in China. It's becoming becoming more and more popular in China as well.
Mm. So he's kind of creating a more sustainable model, sounds like a more ecologically sound model by kind of replicating the food chain. So my question to you, Joel, to be truly sustainable and low impact, what should we be eating? Should we be eating from the bottom of the seafood chain?
Well, this is my favorite question that I ask a lot of the people, whether they're at World Wildlife Fund and some of the environmental groups of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. What do you eat for dinner? What is the most sustainable thing that we can eat from the sea? And invariably, the first thing that comes out of the mouth is shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
Shellfish that you don't have to feed them. They're high in omega-3s. They're low in fats. They're high in protein. And they're filter feeders, so they actually clean the waterways that they're in. I can find no one who's against it or who can say bad things about it. The only concern is, of course, ocean acidification hits shellfish hard, and we're starting to see some impacts of that, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where oyster farms have had some tough times.
And they're not kosher.
That is another thing. But they are delicious.
Joel Bourne, I want to thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Joel Bourne is a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine, and his latest article is called How to Farm a Better Fish. It's in the June issue, and you can, of course, have a link to look at it. Being National Geographic, the photographs are terrific, and so is the research. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.